Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And you know, you live in a city that has been turned over to predators when you read local stories like from NBC5. Here's what to do if you're being carjacked, how to prevent it. Although this doesn't really sound like prevention, actually. This is just basically a PSA in the form of a news story. Give up your car and leave the scene. Is that preventing being carjacked, or is that the completion of being carjacked?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Avoid verbal, physical altercation. If your kid's in the car, tell them, my kid's in the car. If you want to retain possession of your kid, maybe you don't.
That's what they suggest?
Yeah. If there's a child in the car, tell the carjacker, my child's in the car.
Oh, okay. I'll say, Peyton's in the car, and he's 6'7", yeah. And he's going to kill you, and he's armed.
Right.
With a 38.
Yeah, that's helpful.
I can tell them that.
If your kid is, 6'5", and 300 pounds, that's helpful.
What if you have dogs in the car? Does that distract... I mean, does that, ward off carjackers? Because I thought, Hyatt or Bunky or Bubba could be there, the tough dogs in town.
My dog, I would say, my kid's not in the car, but my dog is, and he is a merciless killer.
Sick balls.
Yeah, right. but, I mean, it's just...
I don't mean to joke around about it, but, it's so bad in Chicago. How bad is it? That they're giving you tips on how not to be carjacked.
This is a particularly silly story and particularly annoying. And the record-setting pace of carjackings in Chicago in 2021 is particularly depressing against the backdrop of the story yesterday that was reported, but we didn't get a chance to really talk about it. The 73-year-old Vietnam War veteran who was killed in an attempted carjacking in Hyde Park.
Yeah, and they have arrested... late last night, a 15 and a 17-year-old, and they went up to him in this grocery store and in the parking lot, and said, give us your car. And he fought back, and they punched him repeatedly in the head, and then he collapsed and died of a heart attack. But at least they got the two thugs. So now they're not even using guns. They're just using their fists and killing people.
And, they're still using guns, though, too. Of course, we had these gangland shootings yesterday, two gangland shootings like coming about a few hours apart. 10 people shot Wednesday, two separate gang-related shootings. This mass shootings, by the way, description of these things? Yeah, I understand there's sort of like a criminologist terminology. There's a category that rises to the level of a mass shooting, so for tracking purposes. But it's misleading. They're not mass shootings. They're gangland shootings. They're gang-related shootings. That's what they actually are, and we should call things what they are for the purposes of having a common understanding of what's happening. And so 10 people that were shot yesterday in two separate gang-related shootings in different parts of Chicago a few hours apart. 27-year-old woman struck in the hip, 4-year-old man shot in the face in critical condition, 32-year-old man shot in the lower back, 50-year-old man hit on the side. 36-year-old man shot in the ankle. Do you have some tips? When you're shot, please say, stop shooting. I have kids at home. I mean...
They're even shooting kids. I mean, well, they're just indiscriminately going up to... No, if the gangbanger's in the crowd, they just... Well, they just spray.
Well,
and then run away. But in the past, they would just go up and hit the intended target.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't sharpshooters back in the good old days either. The point is that, yes, there's even... less concern for life than there used to be, arguably. It's not just about the guy wearing the wrong colors in your neighborhood. It's about hey, I'll take out whoever I need to take out in order to get the guy wearing the wrong colors in the neighborhood. And it's, you know, nicely summed up what's happened. What's happened in Chicago? It's nicely summed up in this piece by Charles Fain Lehman, we've had on the show before, over at City Journal, where he explains why cops are quitting. It's nothing, you know, terribly non-obvious. And it was nicely summed up by the one retired NYPD officer that Lehman spoke to. One day, the good guys became the bad guys, and the bad guys became the good guys. And that's the day that you begin the end of civil society, which we have done really a remarkable pace, don't you think, in Chicago? Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and yesterday, okay, well, actually, scratch that.
Switching gears.
Yeah, switching gears. We're pleased to be joined by our friend Frank Ferretti. He's the professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Kent across the pond in the UK. He's also the author of How Fear Works, Culture of Fear in the 21st Century. And Democracy Under Siege, Don't Let Them Lock Us Down. Don't Let Them Lock It Down, I should say. Professor Ferretti, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, part of the culture of fear in the 21st century, How Fear Works, your book, is at the hands, the part of that culture is at the hands of corporate America and corporatists generally in the West. And you write recently about the tyranny of so-called woke capitalism. By the way, that topic, woke, or that term, woke capitalism, boy, that some on the left bristling at that. A piece over at Real Clear Markets by Mark Moore, who's a professor of corporate governance at the University College London, and a senior corporate governance fellow at the Real Clear Foundation. A guy named Bernard Schroffen, write this piece about woke capitalism, and they say the term is misapplied. There's nothing appropriately woke. There's no appropriate description of capitalism as woke just because it's taking into consideration ideology and social justice as part of its risk calculus.
Well, I know that's true, but that's because this guy believes that businesses should no longer be worth business, which is what they were set up to do. Because you have to remember that capitalist companies initially were simply interested in producing products as efficiently as possible, making as much profit as possible, providing the shareholders as well. Whereas now what's happening is that a lot of the companies are no longer simply players in the domain of economics. They're increasingly adopting a political posture, which I think is both bad for their business, but it's also very anti-democratic. Because if big companies like Google and Apple and Goldman Sachs are able to use their economic weight to put people and towns and communities under pressure, they can insist that we live in accordance with their values, and if they don't like what we're doing, they can punish us, then I think you and I and everybody else who's a citizen loses their essential political rights, and this has been happening more and more throughout the world. And it seems to me that what is happening increasingly is that the line, the legitimate line that divides politics from economics, is being lost. And big companies are displacing the role that ought to be filled by politicians that you and I have elected.
Well, here, let me play devil's advocate and say I'm the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and Professor Ferretti, what you have to understand is in order for us to, for example, attract the kind of talent that we need in our business to maximize shareholder value, we have got to adopt these social justice postures because the best and brightest in financial services, say, coming out of the top schools have all been indoctrinated with this philosophy, and if they see the hierarchy of the company not sharing their social justice neo-Marxist philosophy, then they're going to go work for our competitor.
But they argue this, obviously, quite a lot, and to some extent, there is some truth in this. That if you look at the Ivy League universities, the universities that are the most prestigious, they're the ones that are most likely to promote these kinds of values, and these are the graduates from these institutions are the ones they want to get their hands on. However, I would say that at the end of the day, when you have big companies with their considerable economic resources, they're in a very good position to be able to determine, who they can employ, because a lot of people want to work for Google. Hundreds of thousands of young people would love to work for Apple. It's not the case that these companies cannot recruit the people that they would like. I think what they're doing is essentially using that as an excuse in order to legitimate their decision to become political players. And it seems to me that the argument that somehow only people that have these values are any good in the, as employees is mendacious and is extremely dishonest.
But what we've seen, what we said, people who believe in diversity of viewpoint, both as both sort of reflected in law as well as in cultural norms. We said, well, you go woke, go broke. And what we've seen is actually there's not a lot of evidence to support companies that have gone woke, even in spectacular fashion. Nike signing Colin Kaepernick or the Major League Baseball moving the All-Star game. There's not a lot of evidence to show that those companies have taken an economic hit.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think those people that argue this, I argued against them back, a few years ago when they said, go woke, go broke. They were under the misapprehension that somehow, the marketplace would be hostile to the attitude that had flourished in universities, for example. What they couldn't really understand was that the people that ran these big companies were graduates of the very same universities that promoted these values. Even business schools, if you look at all the top business schools, which is Harvard Business School in the United States, you'll find that the ethos that they convey to their students is very, very similar to what you find among social justice warriors in different universities. So what we have is a much bigger problem. And I think that companies have made a calculation. They realize that being woke is not going to cost any kind of economic cost.
Yeah, well,
and not only that, but being woke gives them a certain amount of leverage over the political system. So from that point of view, I think what has happened is that, in a sense, capitalism has changed itself. It's become very different to the way that it would have worked 40, 50, or 60 years ago.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with Major League Baseball here in America, but back in the day, 36 million people would watch the All-Star game. And because they were so woke and they moved the All-Star game out of Atlanta and moved it to Denver, they had horrible ratings, the worst ever. Only 8 million people watched the All-Star game. So sometimes it does backfire, don't you think?
Well, I think sports is very different to any other domain of our life, because I think in sports you still have the ethos of competition. The people who really are into baseball or into football or other sports tend to be very different than people with MBA degrees or the ones that work in large corporations. So I think you're right. But at the same time, if you look at the trend, even within sports, there has been a growing tendency for these ideas to kind of gain a certain degree of legitimacy. And what I really worry about is that gradually, you can see this in football, you can see this in relation to the taking of the knee. You can see the way in which big baseball and football sort of teams change their names under a lot of political pressure. And gradually, even sports is becoming sort of colonized by kind of woke political ideas.
Yeah, and when you see an immediate reaction to something like Major League Baseball moving the All-Star game, and so people don't watch the All-Star game, it's not the same thing as and they're not going out to the ballpark, and they're not following, and they won't continue to watch their favorite team, watch the playoffs when they come around too. I mean, there's not a lot of support for this idea that just because sports or corporate entities become hyper-politicized to the left, that people are making their purchasing decisions or consumption decisions based on that ideology.
It's true. I mean, I got the same issue, the same problem here in England, because I support a soccer team. And me and my son go watch the team every second week when they're playing at home. And, you know, they brought in all these different new rules, which basically mean that we have to watch the words we use, we have to censor ourselves, and we have to play, you know, adopt the rituals, these woke rituals that are coming into soccer. And when I talk to people about it, all the fans, you know, sitting around where I sit, share my ideals, they're really disgusted by it, they're really unhappy about it. But they haven't got the voice, they haven't got the capacity yet to kind of pick up the fuss. And I think the unfortunate thing is that at the end of the day, if you're a sports fan, you put up with all this rubbish in exchange for being able to watch your favorite team out on the field.
Mm-hmm. Well, and going back to corporate America, too, I mean, it's a real consolidation happening. We're not just talking about the CEO and the board. We're talking about legal counsel and the big law firms, too. That's part of the corporate landscape. The American Bar Association is proposing new accrediting standards for law schools that would make them more race conscious and less intellectually diverse. There's a piece by Northwestern law professor John McGinnis on the topic in the Wall Street Journal, and he writes that you know, lawyers regulating their own profession has always been a bit anomalous, but the ABA has an abiding interest in making entry more expensive. It decreases competition for its current members, but now the ABA wants to use wokeness to raise operating costs, impose ideological uniformity, and reduce academic freedom. So now, you know, in your corporate legal department or your corporate law firm, this just becomes one big echo chamber. And I wonder, you know, you know, what you think the implications are in terms of the business landscape and the future of the promotion of free minds and free markets, because at some point the contradictions, just as they were in countries that fail due to their own central planning hubris, at some point the contradictions are going to impose real costs, and whether you're really driving customers away or not, the internal contradictions are going to be too much to sustain anything that could legitimately be called a capitalist economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think the real issue, the most important issue for me, is that all these developments that we're discussing imply that freedom, as we understand it, is downgraded, that, you know, freedom of choice, freedom to say things in accordance with your beliefs, freedom to behave in line with your inclinations. All these things are in a sense called into question. And what we're getting is a perverse situation where capital firms, who in a sense flourish on competition and on the market, are now in the business of both self-regulation, kind of regulating their internal life within their companies, but also regulating everything within society. It's almost as if what these corporates want is a situation where, you know, they can compete against each other in the domain of economics, but everything else becomes totally regulated and totally controlled in line with their particular worldview. Now, that is a very dangerous development, because it means that kind of a diffusion of capitalism and totalitarian impulses.
Well, right.
And have very dangerous consequences. And I think that's what we've got to worry about. And you're right to suggest that at some point, you know, the amount of freedom they're taking away from us will lead to a reactionary, will lead to tension and conflict. But the real danger is that we don't want to wait until we get there. We need to do something about it, slow it down or contain it or even, you know, defeat it a long time before we get there.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, you know, competition, of course, just so long as it's properly, you know, planned out. I mean, that contradiction, that paradox. And look, people forget, you know, every totalitarian society has a business community, too. It's just that the business community has folded into the state. And when you're spending more time rent-seeking for government favor than you are out-competing your competitor, you know, that's the direction you're going.
Yeah, I mean, you already had a very good example of this, a successful example of this in China, you know, where you have the fusion of business and government. And it's relatively successful in global terms. But the main casualty of all this is individual people's freedom. So what you have is a totalitarian system that is economically developed to some extent, and where there are very big firms, rich, you know, corporates, who sit alongside their political friends. But it is a very insidious political dictatorship that prevails there.
And, you know, just going back to your piece, too, about the tyranny of woke capitalism, you know, it's also politically, it's easy to go after Nike with a Colin Kaepernick contract or Major League Baseball. But you don't see a lot of people picking up the sword to go at, rhetorical sword to go after BlackRock or some other big financial services companies. You know, so one of the big questions to your point about the way that to counter what's happening is to take it on in the open with a populist message that exposes the anti-democratic outlook of the oligarchs. Those are your words. But one of the problems is who's really willing to take on these huge players like BlackRock that have huge and sort of quiet influence over everything, including the politicians, including it, probably some op-ed writers. You know, how do you marshal the forces required to take on these massive woke players?
Well, I think you got to do it one step at a time. I think the first and important first step is to make people understand that these large companies, you know, with massive funds, with billions or trillions of dollars at their disposal, like BlackRock, who, you know, are not always very prominent in everyday life. They're not kind of sexy, popular brands, but are phenomenally influential and possess incredible economic resources. And I think we need to wake up and realize the kind of world that we're living in. You know, what these institutions are, what they really represent. And I think that once people begin to understand that these companies, you know, that we very rarely discuss or think about, have a disproportionate impact on their everyday lives, that they determine the kind of values that are being taught in schools, you know, the kids what their kids learn in the classroom. And I think people then, at that point, can begin to mobilize their political power, and that's what's needed. I think you need to have people becoming much more active citizens, not leaving it up to the elections, not leaving it up to the politicians to come along now and again with new ideas, but to put a lot of pressure on the institutions, the democratically elected institutions, as a counterweight to the influence of these corporations.
He is Frank Furuti, Professor Emeritus of Sociology, University of Kent, across the pond in the UK, author of How Fear Works, Culture of Fear in the 21st Century, which is very good. Also, Democracy Under Siege, Don't Let Them Lock It Down. Professor Furuti, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
A pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Listen to AM 560 The Answer online at 560theanswer.com on the AM 560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. First, it was Olivia Rodrigo, a special guest at Jen Psaki's press briefing.
And Dr. Fauci was there to greet her, too, because he had to be part of the action, by the way.
Yeah, she's going to be one of the
Fauciette
leading COVID vaccine ambassadors, I guess. Yeah, one of the Fauci dancers.
Yeah, a Fauciette.
And then yesterday we had Dr. Vivek Murthy. He is the Surgeon General, and he rolled out his Ministry of Truth. But before that, I guess we need to...
Oh, look who's on the line.
Take care of some business with this bet between city worker slash Mike on the North Side and radio talk show host slash volleyball coach Amy Jacobson and Republican primary voter Amy Jacobson.
Thank you.
Mike on the North Side.
Good morning. I finally got a copy of Amy's voting record. There's a lot of disturbing things in there, but she did take a Republican primary ballot in the year that you ran for governor, Dan. So
I know
I have to pay off, and I want to know which charity she wants me to make the check out to.
Amy Jacobson Foundation. Yeah.
Inc.
No. It's got to be a Christian. It's got to be a Christian based charity. It's got to be a legitimate charity, not something like Lesbians for the Metric System made up. If you go back and listen to the tape, I said $500, pick a charity. And she accepted. No, I would recommend one of the three M's. Maryville.
Yeah.
Go back and listen to it.
Maryville, what are the other two?
Mercy Home or Misericordia.
Yeah, those are all great.
Or a children's hospital.
Those are all great. And you're properly shaming her. But I'm not sure. No, I think you're also spending her money now. I'm not sure you said charity.
I don't know.
Go back and listen to it. You could go back at it, 641.
We don't have the technology.
Wait, what time was it? No, we do. 641. I'll look back. 641, yeah. What day was that?
Well, that was on the 14th.
Okay.
And I just want to say, Dan, you owe me an apology. I was not sitting in a place at lunchtime, spent the dollar bills at a fashion show. I was not reading the daily news, making my picks for the hardest racing at Sportsman's. That's a 1980s reference.
I think you also.
And in the 1980s,
In the 1980s,
I was at the CTA. I was not at the city.
I see.
Pete Buttigieg is coming
so,
in today.
So you were sleeping at the job at CTA before you got upgraded to sleep at the job at the water department?
Not the water department. And listen, I work harder than an ugly stripper.
Okay. Well, what department are you with? You're with Streets and Sand, right?
Hey, you know, that's his business. You know? Be careful.
Who I collect a check from is none of your business.
That's right.
Okay, fine.
Just tell me.
He moves around within city government. Just don't worry about it. You know?
Tell me which charity you want me to make the check out to, and I can mail it or drop it off.
All right, listen.
All right.
Well, I know where I'm going.
I grew up on River Road right next to Maryville and went to school with a lot of kids from Maryville, so I'm going with Maryville.
All right, there you go. Maryville it is, Mike.
You will have the check.
All right, and you're gonna send the check in?
Can I get a copy?
You want me to mail it?
No, so you go ahead and send the check in. Don't rely on Amy to do it. Just get it done, but then you have to email us or send us or, you know, carry
the
pigeon.
I was going to send you the check, and you could deliver it if you want.
No. It's your money, and you just put, you know.
You just took my money for my children.
On behalf of Amy Jacobson in the, the notation line on the check, that's all.
I will. I will put Amy's name. She could take the tax write-off.
All right.
And I get to use the cheerful giver.
And I get 10%. And make it $550. That's the 10% juice I get for booking this bet. Send that to Maryville, too. All right? Add another $50 on there. All right. Thanks,
all right,
Mike.
We'll do that.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Good to know Mike on the North Side, not a Welcher.
No.
That's good. All right. Honorable man, Mike on the North Side.
I don't really recall him saying, if I lose the bet, I'll give it to the charity of your choice. But that's all right.
Now what do you do? He called you out. What do you do? If you pocket it, you look, you know.
I look heartless.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the only thing I could think of would be worse is if you, like, I don't know, you had a link card from the school system that you were using.
It's a PEBT card, and it's empty now. That gravy train's over.
All right.
But I did get a child tax credit yesterday for $249.
Of course.
What is going on?
Is there a transfer payment you're not getting?
Well, this is going to last until December, but my neighbor, she's got three kids under the age of six. She's getting $900 a month until December, and the Democrats want to extend this until, you know, infinity.
All right. Apparently, we do have the technology to call up what Mike said the other day when this bet was made, so let's hear it.
Go down to the Board of Elections. Pick a charity.
Oh.
Hmm.
Darn it.
You know, it's a problem. You know, we pay such little attention to what our callers actually say. you can't get tripped up. By. All right, Mike. Mike on the north side was right about that. But there's no bet associated with that. So the 500 that you lost to Amy plus the $50 in juice for me booking the bet goes to Maryville.
Mike is correct.
All right. All right. All right. Now, let's take a break and reset after that. Yes. Get back to talking about things that we're supposed to talk about on this show.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, Dan and Amy, we're now going to get to Dr. Vivek Murthy's Ministry of Truth, his advisory from the Surgeon General yesterday about health misinformation, which is costing lives. See if this doesn't indicate to you the latest frontier of the safetyists who use public health and safetyism as a cover for neo-Marxism.
Surgeon General advisories are reserved for urgent public health threats. And while those threats have often been related to what we eat, drink, and smoke, today we live in a world where misinformation poses an imminent and insidious threat to our nation's health. Health misinformation is false, inaccurate, or misleading information about health, according to the best evidence at the time. And while it often appears innocuous on social media apps, on retail sites, or search engines, the truth is that misinformation takes away our freedom to make informed decisions about our health and the health of our loved ones. During the COVID-19 pandemic, health misinformation has led people to resist wearing masks in high-risk settings. It's led them to turn down proven treatments and to choose not to get vaccinated. This has led to avoidable illnesses and death. Simply put, health information has cost us lives.
There's a key phrase in there, too. The last one, the health has cost lives, because it's always about saving lives with these heroes.
Can't stand it.
But there's something else there, too, that is, I mean, ripped from the pages of 1984. Freedom is slavery. Misinformation robs you of your freedom. So the path to freedom is our elimination of dissent. Freedom is having one opinion and approved information sources, approved sources that are distributing that opinion, approved by a consortium of government and social media companies, and you'll hear that in a second. Murthy went on to say, this is a all-hands-on-deck approach. Everybody has to participate in the compulsory unification of opinion.
Now, we need an all-of-society approach to fight misinformation. And that's why this advisory that I issued today has recommendations for everyone. First, we include recommendations for individuals and families. We ask people to raise the bar for sharing health information by checking sources before they share to ensure that information is backed by credible scientific sources. As we say in the advisory, if you're not sure, don't share.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Does anything concern you about this advisory, which is sort of like guidance, which becomes implemented as a mandate by your local state and local governmental bodies, particularly in the public health space, and by extension and into every other space, since everything is public health now in the era of COVID? Any problems with this? This idea. Hey, Dan, what are you talking about? All he wants to do is make sure things are substantiated. All he wants to do is say, be a little bit skeptical, apply a critical eye to information you come across, bump it up against sources provided by the government that you can cite in terms of advancing a substantive conversation. Are you against substantive conversations? Do you want a bunch of charlatans running around spewing conspiracy theories and fact-free opinions? No, of course not. Of course not. The solution to that, the solution to charlatans spewing fact-free opinions, is for so many of the charlatans that spew fact-free opinions in positions of power to decide what is a credible source and what is not.
Well, they're just trying to scare us into getting vaccinated. I mean, my good friend Emma Woodhouse, that's her Twitter handle,
She put out basic information from Johns Hopkins about cases among children, and she got yanked off Twitter. She's still in Twitter prison for that. She wasn't spewing false math or anything. She was quoting, and there was attribution to Johns Hopkins, and she got pulled.
Yeah, I mean, the examples of this are legion.
What, well, you and I, we had somebody on to talk about how masks don't work, and we got yanked off of YouTube for a few days. Our show did. I mean, it's scary stuff.
So
if you don't agree, they're going to silence you.
So let's use an example here that is real time.
Okay.
The Delta variant. Okay. You have L.A. County reimposing a mask mandate in response to the Delta variant, the slight increase in cases. You have the public health folks in Illinois running around like chickens without necks in response to the Delta variant. Dr. Fauci, you know, everybody in utero you know, everybody beginning in utero needs to be vaccinated in response to the Delta variant just as soon as, I guess, the FDA provides emergency use authorization for in utero to 12, the last frontier.
They're saying our hospitalizations, you know, we have 57 cases a day here in Chicago, and that hospitalizations are up.
Yeah.
And you're not hospitalized for COVID. You're hospitalized for another reason, and you have COVID. And they won't they won't separate that. They're just trying to scare us and push their left-wing agenda.
So everything you're hearing about the Delta variant.
Yes.
Let's put this in the context of this compulsory unification of opinion that's going on. And then you have this piece in the Wall Street Journal. Leslie Beenan and Monica Gandhi. Leslie Beenan is a public health researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Gandhi is an infectious disease physician, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. The reassuring data on the Delta variant is the title of their op-ed. 99% of hospitalizations for COVID are among unvaccinated people. Vaccines are working, including with those that get infected with the Delta variant, including those that have been vaccinated and get reinfected. Because remember,
look at the New York Yankees, what they're going through right now.
Yeah, but nothing is foolproof.
Right.
So, yes, there are some
people. But nobody needs to be hospitalized.
A second question they write is whether a particular variant is making infected people sicker. The question is answered fairly easily by looking at publicly available data from the CDC and comparing hospitalizations per case, particularly in regions where a new variant is more common. We analyzed the CDC data and found the hospitalization data support none of the alarming headlines.
Say it again.
Delta is more dangerous than earlier strains. So and this would be a question for Dr. Murthy. In the new world where everything gets passed through Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth in the Biden administration, who gets silenced? Are you allowed to pass on the research and this op-ed by these two public health professionals, academics? Or do you just have to rinse and repeat the headlines from the D.C. media outlets about the Delta variant and the pronouncements from, you know, everybody from Fauci on down to here locally, Ezekiel and Awardi? Which is it? Who gets silenced? Which is charlatanry? Which is misinformation that's costing lives? Because they both can't be true. As the two authors note, none of the alarming headlines. So somebody's wrong. Somebody's not following the science and data. Who do you think that the Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth will default to? These two researchers or all their friends in the D.C. press corps?
And no one's pushing back. I mean, even what Dr. Awardi tweeted yesterday about hospitalizations. Hospitalizations are basically at almost at zero, Dan. Here's the chart from the CDC. They're lying to us. I mean, they're manipulating people with math and acting like, you know, this what's coming. We're going to have to mask up again. Lockdowns. Nothing's off the table.
Tom in Schererville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, isn't freedom the maximum absence of coercion? The more coercion you have, the less freedom you have.
It's not coercion, Tom. It's guidance.
Oh, that's right.
It sounds like coercion to me.
Well, it's, you know, you use an ugly term. They're just talking about guidance. There's, you know, they, well, these
just 2 weeks
guidances and recommendations. That's all it is.
It's coercion with a friendly voice.
That's about what it is. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tom. Well, especially when, you know, everybody's aligned to move in lockstep with the guidance, with the advisory, with the recommendation. That's all they are. And they're, by the way, as they're willing and able, ready, willing, and able to do that, move in lockstep to implement guidances and advisories and recommendations. Those offering the guidances and recommendations and advisories are working to squelch dissent. But, hey, we're just trying to promote our opinion. Well, we're trying to promote truthful information is what they'd say. It's their view on certain matters. It's just a remarkable position to take, particularly on the matter when the matter involves science, because as we've talked about often, and this is supported by renowned scientists, the science on things never really settled. I mean, that's the scientific method.
I know.
That's the foundation of science, is the basis for making scientific advances, because you're always testing hypotheses. You're always trying to answer unanswered questions in a particular field. And this novel coronavirus that appeared on the scene 18 months ago, these guys have it all figured out. Every step of the way, they've had it all figured out, no matter how many times they've been wrong.
And they've been wrong time and time again. And I'm just fearful that we're going to have to go through this hell all over again in the fall.
Richard in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I think, you know, what's going to happen now is every time you turn on your cell phone, there's going to be a warning. The Surgeon General has determined that free speech is dangerous to your health and may cause death.
Right. Thanks for the call, Richard. Safetyism. Hey. Out of an abundance of caution, we're not going to let you read this thing. The other thing is, it's a continuation in the direction of infantilization, shrinking the citizen. I can't handle something I disagree with. I can't handle something that is wrong. I can't consume something that turns out to be wrong, because whatever I read, I'm going to take as gospel. That's the opinion they're imposing on the great unwashed masses. And by the way, that's how they view you, as the great unwashed masses. Right. Mouth-breathing, knuckle-dragging yokels.
They don't care about you. They don't care about your kids.
Who can't figure out how to get a government ID. And even if you somehow figure out how to get a government ID, you don't know how to photocopy it. This is who they think you are. So you can't contemplate dissenting views. You can't bump up. You will never take the initiative to say, oh, this was an interesting thing I read. I wonder if this is true, and read something else, or have a conversation and somebody exposes you to something else that you hadn't read or that you hadn't heard. And then you have these organic discussions with other sentient beings about matters that are important to you, like your health. No, no, no. You need Dr. Vivek Murthy's Ministry of Truth to protect you from uncomfortable ideas or ill-conceived thoughts or dissenting views. But it's just a guidance. Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning. All right, so as usual, this is, I want to get this out there. I recently was vaccinated. I got vaccinated at 8:30, Wednesday evening. I've been going to the doctor. I've got some, not health issues, but some concerns. My wife and I discussed it for a long time. It was our decision, my decision, that I should get vaccinated. My son is not vaccinated. He has an appointment with a pediatrician that he's been with three. We're going to consult her. But the thing about it that really disgusts me, and I heard this last night going down to batting practice with my son. My 14-year-old son heard that comment from the Surgeon General, and he looked at me and he said, so we're only supposed to listen to what they tell us? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's what they want. I will be fully vaccinated as of middle of August. My wife is. The thing they don't tell you, this lady that you put on, well, you didn't put her on there, but she made the comment that if you're not vaccinated, you're killing my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. If she's vaccinated, she can kill her grandchildren. They don't tell you about the thousands of cases of people that are fully vaccinated that have COVID. And guess what? You can still spread COVID when you're vaccinated. You just don't feel the effects. That's why I got vaccinated, to protect me. Not you, me.
Yeah. Thanks for
they don't tell you that. They're lying on the masks. How long have you guys and everybody known that masks are 100% ineffective, but yet they're going to tell you that they mask? The disgusting part is that they are people who have taken the oath, and they are lying to you, and it makes our whole health industry completely untrustworthy. So who's sowing the seeds of doubt? Who's killing people, like you said? It's not the people who are looking for the real answers. It's not the people who are looking at both sides, trying to filter out what's real and what's not. It's the people who push and push and push this narrative of lies to force you into the vaccine. And the big question is, what's with the vaccine? Why the hard thing in the vaccine? We have two people who, complete morons, leading in the biggest office in this country, who in November and December said they would never put this in their body, not ever, not once.
Yep.
Wouldn't trust it. And then as soon as they took office, they want you to get it. You got to get it. You got to get it. We'll give you a cheeseburger and a shotgun and a free trip to Bora Bora if you get it.
That's right, Jordan. Thanks for the call. We're up against it. We got to go, but appreciate it.
Some call me the sage from South Central. Others call me the czar of common sense. But you can call me Larry Elder. And you're invited to join me tonight, starting at 7, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Larry Elder, newly minted gubernatorial candidate in that California recall election. We'll have to talk to our friend Larry as he's getting his campaign underway this week.
Yeah, he'll be on next week, I do believe.
You know, it's interesting, and making his announcement, he talked about how he had this conversation with Dennis Prager, who approached him to run, and Larry Elder's initial response was that California is ungovernable. I can see that. I wonder about the governability of the city of Chicago, of the state of Illinois, of other big cities like New York City against the backdrop of this high-profile primary election to succeed Mayor Warren Wilhelm out there. All the attention on the Democrat side, obviously, because it's presumed, as is normally the case in big cities, that it will be one of the Democrat socialists who becomes the mayor. But for all the attention Eric Adams has garnered, there is a Republican nominee that is challenging him come the fall, and he is Curtis Sliwa. You know him. He is not only the Republican mayoral candidate for 2021 in New York City, he's the founder and chief executive officer of the Guardian Angels. And he joins us now. Curtis, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. My hands across America to Chi-Town, my second home there. That's where I grew up for my first 5 years, on 46 in Rockwell on the South Side.
Yeah, well, be happy you're not on 46th and Rockwell anymore.
Yeah, it's too dangerous.
But the question about governability, you know, Larry Elder's comments about California, even though he's now pursuing the governor's race, is New York City, has that become ungovernable?
No. Remember, that was what was said before Rudy Giuliani became mayor of the city back in 1992, and I certainly campaigned with him to make sure that happened, because he gave New York City a badly needed attitudinal readjustment in terms of how you deal with crime. But that's the very same thing that was being said then. It's ungovernable. It's too large. It's made up of five boroughs of the city of New York. Maybe we'll separate them into five separate sort of mini cities. That's not the problem. The problem single-handedly is we have Mayor de Blasio, who has taken a Miley Cyrus wrecking ball to this city that we love. Michael Bloomberg had handed him a city that was well-managed, that had low crime rates, that was prosperous, that was the largest and safest city in America. And now we are competing with your city, Chicago, murder capital, drive-by shooting capital, gangbanger capital. We're starting to inch up towards your record violent crime rates.
Well, Curtis, and what the heck happened in New York?
Well, other than the twerking. Yeah.
Right. What happened was we defunded the police by the tune of $1 billion.
There you go.
They are no longer proactive. They've been forced to stand back by the mayor. They are reactive. We've threatened to remove qualified immunity from all police officers, which means they could be personally sued for any action that they take. We've paralyzed them. We've rendered them impotent. And meantime, the gangbangers and the criminals have taken full advantage of that as they commit violent crimes. They're released back into the streets to do it again and again and again. And these are the lessons that we learned in the 90s when we elected Rudy Giuliani to turn the tide. But it just seems that with Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo at the helm of our state and our city, the criminals rule. So that's why I'm running.
Well, but
that's why I'm going to turn it around.
But where's the daylight between you and Eric Adams, who rejected the defund the police, don't allow the police to carry weapons, lunatics in his primary? He's a former NYPD police officer. Is there daylight between you two on this issue?
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of differentiation between I and Eric Adams. First off, last summer when there was rioting, looting, and shooting, he was out there painting every day on the streets of New York with his very dear friend and political mentor, Bill de Blasio, Black Lives Matter, while the city was falling into the pit of anarchy. Now, I was out there fighting the shooters and looters with the Guardian Angels, supporting the police who have been told to stand back. Also, as you know, President Joe Biden recently said, look, out of the $1.9 trillion relief bill for coronavirus, I'll let municipalities, particularly in high crime areas where there's been a horrific rise in gun violence, crime, and gang crime, to use the monies to immediately hire police officers. And what happened here in New York? You had Mayor de Blasio said, no, thank you. Governor Cuomo, no, thank you. Eric Adams, no, thank you. Now, how can you declare yourself to be law and order when you have the president offering money specifically to hire police officers? And when is the last time that Washington was offering money to cities that weren't actually lobbying for it, begging for it, doing everything they could to make noise to get it? Here, the president is giving us the money to hire cops. And all three of these folks are saying, no, I say take the money, hire the cops now, train them, vet them out, get them out into the streets, the subways, and the parks as quickly as possible.
God, I would support you if I lived in New York City, that's for sure. But yesterday, the day before, you got into a little fracas, so to speak, with Eric Adams about the summer jobs program.
Yeah, summer jobs program.
That works.
It's going to take hardcore gangbangers to put down their 9mm and stop slinging drugs. How naive could a person be to believe that a part-time summer job is going to suddenly turn a person who has become a violent enemy of society into a dove, into somebody who is going to reform, somebody who's going to say, absolutely, my next job is I want to get a job at Mickey D's flipping burgers. Are we out of our minds? Now, that may be able to prevent some young men and young women on the periphery from joining gangs and getting in that life of crime and murder and violence that eventually will put them in jail or maybe end up having them killed in the crossfire of competing gangs battling for turf. But that's not going to do anything to stem gun violence.
Well,
that's almost like the gun buyback programs.
It
makes you feel good. But do you really think that a thug, a gangbanger, is going to be turning in a 9mm weapon, which gives him the upper hand over all his adversaries in order to make a few hundred dollars? That's just so totally hopelessly naive, and it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked before.
Well, you have to twin the part-time summer job with either an arts and crafts class or midnight basketball. Then you're really starting to cook with fire.
Right, and what that does is that helps keep kids engaged and maybe out of the specter of getting recruited by gangs. No problem with that. That's a long-term solution. But this is like we need triage now. We need surgeons to go in there to actually stem the flow of the blood that's flowing in the streets. And those surgeons are called uniform and undercover police officers. We don't have enough of them. You don't have enough of them in Chicago. They don't have enough in Cleveland, Baltimore, Washington. I can go right down the list where we have Guardian Angel chapters, so I know that personally. So the fact is, if you're going to stand in the way of hiring more police, then you're not law and order. You're basically catering to the criminal element, which is celebrating, high-fiving one another, knowing there are less cops for them to deal with.
What's your perspective on resurgence of Manhattan? Is Manhattan starting to come back? Do you think it's going to come back? Or, you know, same conversation we're having in Chicago where anything resembling pre-pandemic Chicago probably is at least a generation away. And I wonder what your perspective is on Manhattan.
Well, look, there are a lot of people who are optimistic. They think that all the there's 80% of the commercial space in which people used to work in office buildings is empty. And they're thinking that all of a sudden there's going to be a tsunami of people returning. Well, that's not going to happen for three reasons. Number one, people have learned to work at home. And those people who run those businesses have actually realized, wow, we can save a lot of money by doing that. We don't have the huge overhead. We're not having to pay for leases for space we're not using. Number two, you no longer have to have a shingle in New York City, the economic engine for the world. You could be in Waterloo, Iowa, in this global economy, and you could be a player in the international competitive nature of your business. It used to be you'd have to have a shingle in New York City, even if you were losing money, just for the prestige, just to sort of give you an opportunity to say, hey, we're in New York, number one, second to none. And then lastly, why is anybody going to come to New York City when you have emotionally disturbed persons, homeless people, gangbangers, criminals, thugs, roaming the streets, subways, and parks?
And that's just the city council.
With impunity. Yeah. I mean, tourists, visitors, others, workers. So you have vast stretches of Manhattan that used to be part of a city that never slept 24/7, 365, that sometimes resemble ghost towns.
Well, if you become mayor, how are you going to get people back to New York?
Well, first, you got to get rid of the crime. You have to make it safe for people to come. We have homeless people that have been put into these COVID-19 hotels. Where are tourists going to stay if, in fact, you're expected to be on the same floor as an emotionally disturbed person who's having a psychotic disorder? These people need to be brought to mental health facilities, given their medicine, and compassionately treated. The homeless have shelters, except in our city of New York, the shelters are warehouses. They have to be in by 10 o'clock at night. They get kicked out the door at 7:30. They have no programs for their alcohol problems or their drug addiction or their emotional disorders. If you don't address all those issues, all you're doing is moving the problems around on a chessboard. And with so many other options of places to travel and spend your money, why would you want to risk coming to New York City where you have to run through a phalanx of potential problems that may befall you?
How much of the lockdown strictures that were put in place by Mayor Wilhelm there and with the nipple rings guy over the top, how much of that is central to your campaign, telling people of faith you should have never been, you know, dealt with in that thuggish manner that you were by de Blasio, telling businesses you should never have your livelihood taken away like it was by de Blasio, and so on and so forth? How much is that going to be essentially a referendum question between your candidacy and Eric Adams's?
Well, it still continues. In fact, they're finally going to get the young children and young adults back into the schoolrooms of our vast public school system, but they're ordering them to have to wear masks. They're ordering the teachers to have to wear masks, and you scratch your head and say, wait a second, what's the purpose of that? You know, it's a continuation of government control, a behavior modification. You do as I say, not as I do. There are businesses that their fiscal life has been crushed out of them. They'll never return. They've lost everything, and they've continued the exodus out of the city. I can't tell you how many New York City residents or those who lived in the outskirts but had businesses in New York City have now gone to Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Texas, Tennessee. Every day they're being lured there. And so you have a city in which the wealthy have fled, the upper middle class, the middle class, the poor and the indigent are stuck here. The services at some point can't be provided because we have a looming $5 billion debt that I will inherit as mayor from comrade Bill de Blasio. So we'll be on the brink of fiscal dissolvency. And you say to yourself, well, how are you going to deal with that? Well, you're going to have to tell every agency, every aspect of government, we're going to have to do more with less. And that's not the message that government is used to dealing with. They want to spend, 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 especially here in New York City, like drunken sailors, which they've already done.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, in a city that's, 3-4 to 1 Democrat to Republican, you know, what's the message? What's the essentially the value proposition of your candidacy to appeal to all of those Democrats?
Well, you know, it's actually 8-1. So it's vastly more disproportionate than it was when Giuliani became mayor in the early 90s and when Bloomberg followed him with three terms. So what I've been able to acquire is an independent party line for the general election. That's what Michael Bloomberg spent millions of dollars to try to acquire, which he did. Had he not had the independent party line, even with his millions of dollars, he would not have been elected mayor. And I was able to do it just by getting the required number of signatures. Also, I'm not perceived of as being a hardcore Republican. My opponent in the Republican primary said, oh, this guy's not a Republican. He's a never Trumper. He's not one of us. And I crushed him 72% to 28% amongst Republicans who voted in the primary. And more importantly, I address issues of dealing with the emotionally disturbed persons and the homeless people with compassion. I can go into neighborhoods where the only Republican they've ever seen is Abraham Lincoln on a $5 bill. And I'm the first candidate ever to actually call for no-kill shelters in the animal shelter system of New York City, where if an animal is not adopted within 72 hours, they euthanize them. Thousands of dogs and cats a year at taxpayers' expense. I don't just talk the talk. I walk the walk. I have 16 rescue cats in a 328 square foot apartment. In the
upper wonder Amy likes you so much.
I love
oh my
you,
gosh!
Curtis. I've
oh
got some ferals guy. In my backyard that I love.
Right, and as you know, right. You don't have enough cats in Chicago to deal with all the rat problems.
No, we don't.
We could have sent some of our cats that we're euthanizing in the shelters to Chi-Town to help you with your rat, your rodent, and your mice problem.
Yeah, we need a feline exchange
we're
between
taking,
the two cities.
Instead of euthanizing the cats, people take them and have cat colonies. But we can talk about that later,
I
can send you photos.
I'll let you guys hash that out in your affinity group. Curtis Sliwa, website for people to get more information on your candidacy.
Oh, just go to CurtisSliwaForMayor.com. That's CurtisSliwaForMayor.com. And you can assist me in preventing the continued domination of Democrats in New York City, like in Chicago, that are driving us right into the abyss.
He is Curtis Sliwa, Republican / independent. Maybe you need a nickname, too. How about Catman Curtis Sliwa?
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. Just workshopping. Republican and independent candidate for mayor of New York City come November, founder and chief executive of the Guardian Angels as well. Curtis, thanks for joining us. Good luck.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, everybody, pay attention. Freedom Night is coming up, and it's a great way to show your support and meet other conservative leaders in your area. It is Thursday, July 22nd. Thursday, July 22nd. Join Jeannie Ives and other conservative leaders for Freedom Night at the Abbey Resort in Lake Geneva. Get your tickets and find out more at oneundergod.org. That's the number one, undergod.org. Let me say it one more time. The number one, undergod.org. And we'll see you there.
All right. So there's this new group of books out on President Trump's final days, including one by Michael Wolff. And I, for the life of me, I don't understand why Trump sat down with Michael Wolff. Remember, he's the Hollywood reporter who wrote Fire and Fury, that creates such a fury when it first came out. And then he basically, I don't know if he reestablished or he just disclosed what the standard for the press corps was during the Trump era, which is his words. If it sounds true, it probably is. If it sounds true, it probably is. That's what Michael Wolff said about his book and details in the book that were challenged, and not just by the Trump administration. But now fast forward a few years, and Trump sat down with Michael Wolff after working feverishly to prevent the publication of Fire and Fury a few years back. I don't understand. And trying to separate not just hyperbole from the truth in some of these books, but also the importance of some of these disclosures. And they're always sort of leaked to generate interest in the book, of course. So some of this stuff, like Justice Kavanaugh becomes latest target of Trump's ire. Well, Trump's disappointment in Kavanaugh in Kavanaugh's decisions in the context of the recently concluded Supreme Court term, there's a lot of conservatives who have questions about Kavanaugh,
right,
who are disappointed in some of the positions that he took on the important cases before the court. The most serious charges, I guess, are that there was, and these books are sort of blending together, Trump was, and generals feared that he would pursue a coup. He would stay in office.
Right. Yeah.
And this was something, this is like news. This was something that was being suggested without evidence by Democrats, I don't know, since Trump got elected. And certainly after he lost the election in November of 2020. Is he going to stay in office? Is he going to try and enlist the military and all the hyperventilating? And there's no evidence that was ever going to happen or anybody was going to abide that silliness, starting with the president. Distortions here, sans something very compelling and not just, you know, Trump's offhanded hyperbole, his own self, which punctuated his entire life, not just his political career, but still, when it's convenient, they take Trump literally rather than directionally, as Selena Zito famously said, you should. Don't take him literally, but take him seriously, the direction he wants to go, not necessarily some of the specifics and not always necessarily great command of the facts. Well, one of the books that's getting a lot of play is Michael Bender's. Michael Bender's a senior White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His book, Frankly, We Did Win This Election, The Inside Story of How Trump Lost. Michael Bender, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So one of the things that I've seen from some of the write-ups, I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but from some of the write-ups, you know, some of the, I guess, important excerpts from the book, this, which is why they're being released concurrent with its release, Trump's assessment of candidates he would face in 2020 and how that debate raged within the campaign of who should be taken seriously and who should not.
Yeah, that's right. The difference in my book, really from any Trump book that's been written yet, and I'm sure of anyone that's going to be released this year, is that I'm the only one that goes. I've covered Trump for 5 years as a candidate twice, to both elections, and 4 years at the White House for the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, plays the its news pages with a straight as bad as any news organization. And I take readers inside the room in the Oval Office in the White House, behind the scenes at the campaign where, you know, they spent $2 billion and we're still chasing Joe Biden at the end of the race from behind. And I also embedded for 2 years with some of Trump's most hardcore supporters, the folks who go to 30, 40, 50 rallies that, over and over again to understand, why they like Donald Trump so much and want to see that show over and over again. And, you know, one of the really through lines of this book was revealing to me was the infighting underneath Donald Trump and sort of every iteration here. And that he really wasn't well served by it, even though he did encourage it quite a bit. But some of the scenes that are in this book include Ronna McDaniel, the chairwoman of the Republican Party, and Jared Kushner's senior advisor, getting into a argument in a Trump hotel ballroom over the creation of some fundraising software that that Jared wants to himself and that Rana wants to keep inside the party, thinking that it's going to be a long-term investment for the party. And Jared, you know, turns to Owen Point and says, "No, I don't give an F about the party." And you know, this is what's happening, and where the arguments are, instead of how to get Trump a second term, it's how can I, you know, build this off, or how can I continue the party? I mean, even into the last days, I detail some meetings for the first time where they have to have sit downs so that that Rana is in the same meetings with the campaign manager, Bill Stepien, because they're not even talking to each other at the end. Not which states are we going to win, or how do we win Michigan, or how do we make sure we win Georgia again, or what is going on in Arizona. But you have to make sure you're talking to the chairwoman of the Republican Party in order to stay on the same page. You know, it's striking stuff for me when I was reporting this book.
Well, so here, look, I appreciate your distinguishing yourself from, like, the Michael Wolfs of the world and your experience that informs this book. But I got, so, like, on that, that's an example. I mean, you know, I haven't been in a presidential campaign, but I've run and been a candidate for statewide office. I've been around governor's races and Senate races. And you know, look, infighting and campaigns at that level, not unusual. Infighting between the campaign and the party, not, you know, especially over turf battles, not unusual. So, I mean, personalities clash, interests collide, mission focus gets lost. I mean, that's not particularly novel to Trump world.
Well, at this level, it is. In 2016, it was a shoestring operation. They ran the campaign with a plane and a telephone Trump could call in and do his interviews and an aide to take dictation. I mean, that was the long and short of it.
Right.
This time around, it was a $2 billion operation. They had hundreds and hundreds of staffers. In order to win, in order to keep that operation moving in the right direction, you know, or to have, operations in place where you have capable lawyers challenging your, making your case on election day, before election day. You know, these are the kind of things that there need to be in place ahead of time and need people rolling in the same direction.
I agree. But and on that score, that's actually interesting. On that score, what were the discussions like, if any, about the sort of ballot integrity program they needed to run with this, you know, mostly mail-in election and the sort of legal presence they needed in big cities and swing states on election day and the preparations for anything that may transpire that they would need to be in court, you know, shortly after election day? What were those were high-level discussions had on those topics?
They didn't have them. I mean, they weren't in place. Mm-hmm. And this book details that their data operation was wrong. They were scrambling to put it together in the final days. I mean, I'll tell you, it's in the book. They told President Trump on election day that they were going to win Georgia by 4 points, at least 4 points. I mean, that's not a close race, 4 points. You know that. Again, had this data operation been in place for a year, Trump announced his reelection, put Brad Parscale in charge of the thing in 2018, earlier than anyone. I mean, had this thing been in charge even for in operation for even a year, and focused on and received the kind of focus it deserved, maybe it'd be a different story.
Well, Michael, a lot of people feel like President Trump didn't run against Biden. He ran against COVID. And did he feel that, you know, the virus is going to ruin the economy and cost him the election?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he viewed COVID in very personal terms very quickly. He understood. It's hard for people to remember that 2020 opened up really at the political high watermark of the Trump presidency. Yes, he had been impeached, the first time, but he was acquitted. He survived. He didn't just survive. He was thriving. The American public blamed Democrats for wasting their time. It turned out to be boondoggles for the fundraising operation. and the economy was red hot. The trend line was pointing in the right direction. The polling was showing a runaway victory for them.
Right.
And then COVID quickly. I mean, Trump just felt the rug being taken out from underneath him. And I have some conversations in the book behind the scenes where he identifies this very quickly and sees sees the through line there. This is going to hurt the economy, which is going to hurt me. It was, I think, about a lot of it about COVID, and that was a big difference in 2020. But again, I have some internal polling in here for the first time that showed really mixed messaging. And to get back to this idea of the internal rivalries, they didn't really know. There was a lot of arguments on how to attack Biden, when to attack Biden, how early to attack Biden, and you can see it in the polling where ask voters an open-ended question of what have you heard Trump talk about in the last couple of weeks, and you get 15 different answers. And I'm not kidding. Everything from him talking about winning the Nobel Prize to Biden, to COVID, and then you ask the same question about Biden at the end, and it's all versions of COVID. COVID's hurting the country. COVID's hurting the economy. COVID, this president is unfit to handle COVID. Right? All in the same theme, and I think that makes a difference at the end too. I mean, again, for 2016, "Make America Great Again" the president's message was spot on. It was very clear. It's something people could understand. And 4 years later, he struggled to find that direct message, a single message that he could get behind and that people could latch onto.
When, with respect to COVID, any indication that he considered replacing Fauci and Birx at some point during the response to the virus, or if not replacing them, expanding the circle of public health advisors on which he would lean to make decisions?
I mean, we saw that play out in real time, right? And there are some new details in the book here, one of which is a conversation in the Oval Office in which Scott Atlas appears before he had come on TV for the administration, before he'd been hired as an advisor. This is the California doctor who had been on Fox.
Stanford, right. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And he brings him in and introduces him to some of his political team and asks, Trump asks Alice, well, tell them what you told me. And again, this is summer of 2020. He says, well, COVID will be done and over by September. Yeah. And some of the staff, the senior campaign team are just kind of shaking their heads. He says, no, we'll be done by September. I mean, obviously that was not the case. Listen, Scott Atlas is not a doctor that studies viruses like COVID, he was telling Trump what the most optimistic scenario,
here's my thing.
Scott will serve at the end of the president.
Yes, so we know the Scott Atlas thing, and I understand that part of it. But that was still pretty deep into it by the time he came on. And to the extent that he says something like that and the senior advisors have questions, what were the senior advisors saying? We have all these epidemiologists that disagree with Fauci, guys like John Ioannidis at Stanford and Sunetra Gupta at Oxford and Martin Kulldorff at Harvard. Well, why are we not expanding the circle to get more expert opinions on what should be done with respect to recommending lockdowns and all of these other protocols, a lot of, which now in retrospect, the research is, not particularly favorable to those lockdowners' positions. But it doesn't seem like that conversation ever happened. If not replace Fauci and Birx, then expand the circle to get other people equally as credentialed, equally as expert, who have different views on how this should be approached.
Well, I think the answer there is what we saw is that the president wanted someone who was going to tell him what Atlas told him, was that this thing was over. Not that that's not the nuance of it, right? There's a lot of nuance there, but it's you know, it takes time and energy and space to understand those things and you know, digest that kind of information. And Alice was willing to tell him that it was going to be done. But you know what? The political people were telling him, you know, the masks were an 80% issue. You know, 80% of Americans said they would wear a mask. But Trump had other people telling him that if you wore a mask, the media would kill you for capitulating to them. And, you know, and that's what the debate looks like around the president. Not what is, how to win a fight with the media. Not what's best for him or best for the country.
Yeah, I mean, half the country would hate it if he wore one, and half the country hated that he didn't wear one. But speaking of COVID, you're making, you know, national news this morning because of something that you said yesterday in an interview, that President Trump thought he would die from COVID. Can you walk us through that?
I don't know that.
Were you misquoted?
I'm actually not sure what that quote is. He was very, very sick after he was infected with COVID. And I do think there is even more reporting to be done on exactly how sick. I mean, obviously they brought him to Walter Reed Hospital. He wanted to, obviously, you know, as any president would, appear healthier than he was. He wanted to appear strong and, for the...
Right.
Yeah, he carried his own suitcase in.
Carries his own suitcase in, and he's so exhausted but he's so exhausted and so sick that as soon as he walks into the door, he drops the bag, and everyone around him, and you know, probably naturally, instinctively, he is sick with COVID, takes a step back, and it's Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, who after a beat, leans in, picks up the bag, and carries it to Trump's room, and Trump tells people later that. That's the moment he knew Mark Meadows was his guy.
There was an indication in a piece about Bill Barr that this is not related to you or your book, but there was an indication that Barr said something to Trump about his post-election legal team being a clown show, and Trump essentially said, "Well, I don't necessarily disagree with you." His disappointment with the people that he chose to put around him, or he chose to give the green light to. And one of the people that I think is worthy of more reporting, too, he's been enigmatic in terms of his role all the time, is Jared Kushner. And why so much trust in Jared Kushner in Trump world?
Well, I don't know that there was trust in Jared in Trump world. I think...
Well, by the president himself, I mean.
By the president himself, exactly. A couple of things. He's married to his favorite kid, Ivanka. Right. Let's just care about that.
Yeah. Right.
He's from a Jewish real estate a successful real estate family in the tri-state area, which is I point that out because it's important for Trump growing up. He's not the Anglo-Saxon, Saxon. He's Donald Trump grew up in Queens. Jared Kushner grew up in Jersey, they're bridge and tunnel guys, right? They were mocked by the landed gentry in New York, the WASPy types who kept them out of their country club, that sort of thing. So there is a level that he identifies with the Kushner family, and the endorsement he has from Ivanka. I think those are all important. And at the end of the day, family is important to Donald Trump, right? There's a very clear distinction for him between if you're not family, you're staff. And it's sort of simple as that.
Interesting. That's an interesting perspective. Before we let you go, since you were so close to Trump and his teams, both political and governmental, for so long, do you have a perspective on whether or not you think he'll run again in 2024?
I do think that he very much likes to keep himself in the headlines, right, or bad. And I think that goes to circle back to your earlier question about why he sits down for these interviews. He very much just wants to be part of the story, and for good or bad is my perspective. But the people around him are urging him to wait until at least 2022 election, there's a lot of data points coming. He's endorsed, what, two dozen candidates all the way from U.S. Senate to Staten Island borough president. So someone's going to be, you know, waiting to see how those play out. He's made a handful of endorsements in Republican primaries to challengers to incumbents, and that's not an easy thing to pull off, even for a former president who's as popular in the party as Donald Trump. So all that's going to inform his decision into 2024. But I think, you know, this is really, it really is a choice for the Republicans in 2022. The big decision to have is whether or not to redefine the party post-Trump. And I think one of the things that this book does is show, is give a very clear portrait of the presidency of Donald Trump as a candidate, and, you know, and provide key data points in order to make that decision.
He is Michael Bender, senior White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and author of the just-released book, Frankly, We Did Win This Election, The Inside Story of How Trump Lost, which I'm anxious to read after this conversation. Michael Bender, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, before we get to the collapse of civilization, which is predicted to be about 2040, according to a research published in the Yale Journal of Industrial Ecology, which I know is your regular reader of, Amy.
It's near and dear to my heart.
A reaction to our interview with Michael Bender and his book on Trump and the last days of the campaign and his presidency. George in Libertyville.
Hey, Dan, thanks for taking a call. You know I speak for millions of us. It's so tiring to now hear all these pundits come out with these books, How Trump Lost the Election. If you ask tens of millions of people, a guy that got 75 million votes did not lose this election. And when are books going to start being written about when was the last time other than this election that voting situations were shut down in the middle of the night? You have all these videos of all this impropriety and the investigations onto that. That's number one. Number two, I remember sitting out of town when COVID broke, watching the news, and it wasn't within 24 hours of COVID breaking, the Democrats started screaming for mail-in voting being necessary because it was going to be too dangerous to go to the polls. People are tired of hearing this, and if you ask us, the scam of what happened is becoming more evident every day. And well, he did not lose.
Well, you know, thanks for the call, George. Even if, I mean, he's not the president of the United States. So that's where it's at. I mean, we can make a very similar argument, perhaps even a more compelling argument about Richard Nixon in 1960 against JFK. But JFK was the president. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying, and you can play out the if there were no mail-in ballots, you know, if the election in 2020 was administered in all the states the way it was in 2016, would Trump have lost?
Well, COVID certainly changed the way we run elections, and the Democrats seized on that. Their mail-in drop box, we never had those before.
What?
20, you know, drive-in voting, everything.
I know.
And then all of that, and on the day of the election, the CDC comes out and says, yeah, it's okay as long as you wear, if you have COVID and you're asymptomatic or if you're feeling okay, you can go to the polls and vote. I thought that was an onion piece. It said wear a mask, gloves, and bring your own pen. But you can go vote after all that.
Well, look, it's all going to be over soon enough for all of us.
Oh, it is?
Humanity won't exactly cease to exist. But according to Gaia Harrington in the study published in the Yale Journal of Industrial Ecology I mentioned, basically our industrial civilization could end by about 2040 if we don't stop overexploiting our resources and change course and so on and so forth. More Neil Malthusian pap. But even before that, it doesn't even matter if civilization ends by 2040, because in the next 10 years, big tech could control our minds with brain chips, according to scientists as well. This is going to be like
chips we have on our Visa and MasterCards?
Well, you know, it's just like Lori Lightfoot wants to assemble a pre-crime unit here, like Minority Report. well, this is going to be like Inception. We're all going to be chipped, and that's going to be in a decade, so we won't even be ourselves anymore. So why worry about this stuff? You know, I mean, the 2020 election will be old news. Nobody will remember it because
we're going to be taken over. Mind banks
will have been erased. And speaking of the takeover, maybe even faster than a decade for some people. Jen Psaki yesterday at press briefing, after Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy's toxic positivity in favor of protecting Americans from views that dissent with the established orthodoxy emanating from the White House, she offered more on that. So it doesn't just end with the Surgeon General's guidance. And by the way, don't you long for a Surgeon General that just focused on promoting masturbation as opposed to mind control?
Who was that?
That would be Jocelyn Elders.
Oh.
And Jen Psaki says...
No, I don't long for those days. Yeah.
Well, as compared to mind control? Mm. As compared to censoriousness from Vivek Murthy? I don't know. Psaki, full court press for propaganda. The recommendations, guidance, advisory that they're making, the Biden administration, to social media companies to, you know, tighten up their shop when it comes to messaging to the unwashed masses.
The take, I should say, from the federal government, we've increased disinformation research and tracking within the Surgeon General's office. We're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. We're working with doctors and medical professionals to connect to connected medical experts who are popular with their audiences with accurate information and boost trusted content. So we're helping get trusted content out there. We also created the COVID Community Corps to get factual information into the hands of local messengers. And we're also investing, as you all have seen, in the president's, the vice president's, and Dr. Fauci's time in meeting with influencers who also have large reaches to a lot of these target audiences who can spread and share accurate information. You saw an example of that yesterday. I believe that video will be out tomorrow.
I can't wait to hear what Olivia Rodrigo has to say about the vaccines. I'm going to watch her video while I listen to her sing Driver's License. okay, so that's what's going on. It's all good news. You see the government, all the things they're doing to stop the spread of misinformation. It's exciting, isn't it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do you see anything that could be problematic about it? Well, before you make your decision, Jen Psaki outlined four proposals that they have generously offered to Facebook and other social media platforms to make sure that misinformation, meaning dissent, does not spread.
There are also proposed changes that we have made to social media platforms, including Facebook. And those specifically are four key steps. One, that they measure and publicly share the impact of misinformation on their platform. Facebook should provide publicly and transparently data on the reach of COVID vaccine misinformation, not just engagement, but the reach of the misinformation and the audience that it's reaching. That will help us ensure we're getting accurate information to people. This should be provided not just to researchers, but to the public, so that the public knows and understands what is accurate and inaccurate. Second, that we have recommended, proposed that they create a robust enforcement strategy that bridges their properties and provides transparency about the rules. So I think this was a question asked before, there's about 12 people who are producing 65% of anti-vaccine misinformation on social media platforms. All of them remain active on Facebook, despite some even being banned on other platforms, including Facebook, ones that Facebook owns. Third, it's important to take faster action against harmful posts. As you all know, information travels quite quickly on social media platforms. Oh, nice. Sometimes it's not accurate, and Facebook needs to move more quickly to remove harmful violative posts. Posts that will be within their policies for removal often remain up for days. That's too long. The information spreads too quickly. Finally, we have proposed they promote quality information sources in their feed algorithm. Facebook has repeatedly shown that they have the levers to promote quality information. We've seen them effectively do this in their algorithm over low quality information, and they've chosen not to use it in this case, and that's certainly an area that would have an impact. So these are certainly the proposals.
Well, that's a long, long, long
long list of demands there.
Isn't that exciting?
Wow.
That nobody will ever be treated to misinformation again, yeah, thanks to the Biden administration working in concert with social media companies?
Our way or the highway. Well, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Anything you think could go wrong there? Any potential pitfalls, downsides to the government's collusion with social media companies to eradicate misinformation on COVID or any other topic? Anything that could be troubling about that may not work out quite as they're offering it to you. No, I get it. Hey, under the spreading chestnut tree, I sold you, you sold me. There lie they, and here lie we, under the spreading chestnut tree. All is good.
It's very nice, Dan.
It's Orwell from 1984.
Right. Well, I didn't think you.
Joe in Arlington Heights.
Good morning, guys. Just to help illustrate how terrifying this is, imagine in the days of print media being the dominant messenger. If an administration said, folks, you can't print anything until we bless it. And even more terrifying, then the publishers say, okay, this should scare everybody right down to their boots.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Joe.
And it's not going to stop, and they're not going to walk that back anytime soon. Never.
You know, Joe Biden had this to say yesterday with in his little confab with Angela Merkel about communism and socialism.
Oh.
And communism is a failed system, universally failed system. Uh-oh. And I don't see socialism as a very useful substitute, but that's another story.
Sure.
Has AOC and Bernie Sanders fought back yet?
It's something you say when you see Venezuela melting down, when you see the oppressed revolt in Cuba. That's something when you see the oppressed revolt in Hong Kong, it's something you say. You make a paean to democracy and you say, essentially, you know, these autocratic Marxists, that doesn't work. Yeah. And then it's then you pursue policies like your press spokes being just outlined. Antonio Garcia Martinez is a reporter, spent some time in Cuba. He wrote at Barry Weiss's Substack about the real Cuba. It's not a Potemkin Airbnb as it was presented to be during the Obama years Joe Obama terms 1 and 2.
All inclusives, right, in Cuba.
He writes, does Garcia Martinez, it's hard to convey to those who live in a free world what life is like under a totalitarian dictatorship. I've never experienced anything remotely like it before I traveled to Cuba. In order to report a story for Wired magazine, it was one of the most memorable and unpleasant experiences of my life. This is back in 2017, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. The first thing is fear. You as an individual exist naked without any recourse against the depredations of the state. The second thing you notice is the deception. To live in Cuba is to live in a web of lies. It begins with the media, which is pure propaganda repeated by everyone, chorus-like or else. As a cope, everyone has a half dozen make-believe realities in their heads, which they selectively deploy depending on whom they're addressing. And by the way, this is the same exact thing that you've heard from former Eastern Bloc subjects, dissidents, about the two lives you have to live in a totalitarian society, the public life and the private life. Live a web of lies. The American tourists who visited Cuba during the Obama period saw nothing other than a Potemkin Airbnb reality they inhabited for a few dollar-fueled days. To really feel the brunt of the Cuban state, you need to live as Cubans do, or run afoul of the sliver of relative freedom the state affords foreigners. And he shares a couple of anecdotes to that end. He concludes his piece, does Martinez Garcia, in part by saying, the sad reality is that countries can and do choose to commit suicide, as we've seen with Syria and Venezuela more recently, and Cuba 3 generations ago. Embracing some revolutionary philosophy that promises to heal all ills and right all wrongs, and then exploiting the worst human tendencies to implement that wild-eyed vision is the sure path to ruin. America is not remotely at the level of Cuba, but it sure seems We have a growing taste for apocalyptic politics and orthodoxies enforced by public acts of repudiation. Boy, it sure does seem we have a growing appetite for those things, don't we? And this is the end of the road if it's one you want to travel. Carol in Moments.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, what's being lost? Well, of course, I can't believe the amount of fear out there. I just look at people and I go, oh, my God, why are you afraid? It's a lousy virus. And how about reporting? They don't report all the adverse reactions to this vaccine. They're just not. I mean, there's thousands of people that are then killed or they're permanently injured from it. And then they also seem to have forgotten. Nobody's talking about the value of early treatment with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin.
Yeah.
If you start it before the ER sends you going, saying, go home, come back when you're sicker. If hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were started at that point, thousands of people would not have died.
Thanks for the call, Carol. Appreciate it. Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. About a year ago this time, anyone that wanted to advocate opening schools were called child killers. And if we had this Ministry of Truth back then, all the posts and all the arguments saying why we should reopen schools, those would have been shut down. But who turned out to be right? The people that didn't want to lock down, the people that demanded schools be reopened, and the schools that were open. Did anyone die of COVID? No, but how many teens committed suicide because the government and their Ministry of Truth ruined their lives?
Thanks for the comment. I mean, the context here is they don't want you to have any of these conversations, agree or disagree, on any aspect of COVID-related policy. And look, once you start eliminating dissent to save lives when it comes to COVID, you can do that for everything else they identify as a public health crisis. I mean, these are people that believe, you know, gun violence is a public health crisis, which is their way of saying guns, the existence thereof.
They're saying racism.
A public health crisis. Racism is a public health
crisis. Gun violence is part of that five.
You can save lives if we just eliminate dissent. When Justice Robert Jackson, in one of the best opinions in the history of the Supreme Court, wrote in West Virginia v. Barnett that compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard, he was talking about the likes of Dr. Vivek Murthy's Ministry of Truth, this administration, and the neo-Nazis. And that's what they are. Neo-Marxist isn't strong enough. The neo-Nazis who are so intent on making tomorrow day one in America. This is who Justice Jackson was talking about, warning about. And all you have to do is look around at failed states where people have been oppressed for generations, as our neighbor 90 miles south of Miami is providing in real time.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I just cannot play this toxic positivity from Dr. Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, enough. Again, his guidance, just guidance yesterday.
Surgeon General advisories are reserved for urgent public health threats. And while those threats have often been related to what we eat, drink, and smoke, today we live in a world where misinformation poses an imminent and insidious threat to our nation's health. Health misinformation is false, inaccurate, or misleading information about health, according to the best evidence at the time. And while it often appears innocuous on social media apps, on retail sites, or search engines, the truth is that misinformation takes away our freedom to make informed decisions about our health and the health of our loved ones. During the COVID-19 pandemic, health misinformation has led people to resist wearing masks in high-risk settings. It's led them to turn down proven treatments and to choose not to get vaccinated. This has led to avoidable illnesses and death. Simply put, health information has cost us lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So get vaccinated or else.
Well, it's so much bigger than that. Freedom. To hear dissenting views is to have your freedom threatened. This is essentially, I mean, this is substantively the same as Orwell's Freedom is Slavery in 1984. That's what Dr. Murthy is saying. And he wants everybody to participate in making sure people understand that freedom is slavery.
Now, we need an all-of-society approach to fight misinformation, and that's why this advisory that I issued today has recommendations for everyone. First, we include recommendations for individuals and families. We ask people to raise the bar for sharing health information by checking sources before they share to ensure that information is backed by credible scientific sources. As we say in the advisory, if you're not sure, don't share.
Exactly, and the American Booksellers Association took that to heart. The American Booksellers Association, in the business of promoting authors and booksellers and, content, apologized Wednesday for a, quote, terrible and serious violent incident. Sounds like a public health threat. What was it? They sent out a paperback copy of Abigail Schreier's Irreversible Damage book on transgender.
Oh, my.
Terrible, serious, violent incident, the American Booksellers Association described it, because some of the members of the American Booksellers Association want Abigail Schreier purged, just like the minders at the social media platforms. Terrible, serious, violent incident. What can't you include under the umbrella of public health and saving lives per the guidance that you heard from Dr. Murthy?
Huh. Everything's in an abundance of caution.
It's funny. I mean, even that guy from Dude, Where's My Car gets it. My sense is that what social media is today is not what social media is going to be in 5 years. If the trend line continues on the path it is today, my kids will not be on social media. If the trend line pivots, as I think it likely will, there's a chance that I will allow them to use it. And he also mentioned how concerned he is the Chinese Communist regime could use TikTok to push anti-U.S. propaganda. I'm talking about Ashton Kutcher.
Really? My Iowa Hawkeye grad?
Yeah, the guy from Dude, Where's My Car?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
He's
that's the thing he was in. I don't remember anything else. And he was married to Bruce Willis's ex-wife. I know that.
That would be Demi Moore.
And Ashton Kutcher gets it.
Well, he's smart. He went to Iowa. Brilliant mind.
Yeah, right. And the fascinating, you don't have to worry about TikTok pushing anti-U.S. propaganda. You have to worry about the U.S. government pushing anti-U.S. propaganda. Going back to that piece from Antonio Garcia Martinez on Cuba, America was not built on content moderation and problematic this and that when it comes to speech. That's not America. That's not American. It's anti-American. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Chadwick Moore, contributing editor for The Spectator. Chadwick, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Also a fellow Hawkeye here.
Oh.
That's not anything I brag about, Chadwick.
Hey, you stay out of this, Prof. What year did you graduate, or is that too personal?
2005.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very old.
Right. Amy was part of the first graduating class.
No, I'm part of I'm the Ashton Kutcher era. Uh-huh. Thank you.
All right. So, Chadwick, you're a journalist. So I would think that, you would be, consistent with the D.C. Press Corps, you must be excited about this new assault on misinformation so that everybody has the same information, the same viewpoint, and we can all come to agreement or else.
True. If I were a real journalist and not the hack that I am, then I, of course, would be celebrating the government cracking down on dissenting voices and endorsing only one side of the argument. What's interesting, too, is I don't know if you saw Jen Psaki yesterday saying that they're flagging, they're in contact with Facebook, flagging misinformation and posts. Terrifying, number one. And they've also identified, I think they said they narrowed it down to 12 individuals who
anti-vax.
Are spreading the most misinformation. Yeah. Wow. If you're not on that list, you are not cool, apparently. This is interesting, too, because this kind of comes back to Trump's lawsuit against big tech, in which he is basically alleging that big tech has become an arm of the federal government. That if they are acting on behalf of the federal government, then they must respect by law every citizen's First Amendment rights. I mean, they can't be censoring people so willy-nilly as they do. And here we have the Biden administration admitting that, yes, Facebook is an arm of the federal government. We are in contact with them, and we are working with them to censor people. So that could have interesting implications for Trump's lawsuit. I'm not really sure if it'll be successful or not, but at least it gets that information out there and is raising some interesting points. And we're learning more and more about exactly what's going on behind the scenes with the marriage between big tech, the federal government, the Democrat Party, and censorship.
Well, you're right. And, you know, the argument that Trump makes in the suit is essentially that these social media platforms are acting as agents of the government. Well, when you have, as Psaki outlined yesterday, your recommendation, you know, everything's a recommendation and a guidance and advisory, and it all of a sudden becomes the compelled orthodoxy. But when you have them in contact with these social media platforms, here's four proposals we'd like you to implement, then, you know, you start to really connect the dots to, you know, maybe they are de facto agents of the government, and maybe they are subject to First Amendment strictures.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the whole like, my private company argument really goes out the window. But of course, I mean, but these companies have always had, they benefit from the federal government, from the American people. They would never have been able to achieve the amount of wealth and power they have without the special privileges granted to them by the American people through the federal government, through Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which they, of course, are in complete violation of the terms. This is, of course, the rule that says that they are, as long as they don't editorialize, as long as they're neutral platforms, they can't be basically sued for libel and defamation in the same way that something like the New York Times could. Now, that, of course, they don't uphold those rules. In civil court, at least twice, Facebook has argued that they are, in their own words, they are publishers, not neutral platforms, and therefore they're allowed to censor people because they have an editorial voice. They brazenly say that in civil court, and I imagine they will be forced to argue that in the Trump case. And yet, sitting before Congress, Mark Zuckerberg and others will say, no, we're neutral platforms. And so they're flat out lying in one of those instances. And but they're so powerful. I mean, big tech spends more money lobbying in Washington than anyone. Right. So I'm not sure anything will change, to be honest. And even though they're just blatantly rubbing it in everyone's faces how corrupt they are and how much they're misusing the benefits the American people have given them that have allowed them to become so big and so powerful. Because without Section 230, none of these companies would survive. You could sue Facebook every time anyone said something negative or slanderous about you on the platform. There'd be millions of lawsuits against these companies.
Well, let's talk about the changing of our rhetoric in the world we live in and how moms are not moms anymore. We're birthing people.
Right. Yes, I recently wrote about this in The Spectator that Cori Bush kind of started this right before Mother's Day, how nice of her, referring to women, mothers, as birthing people. The Biden administration then included this in a budget proposal, replaced the word mothers, birthing people. So what this kind of comes to that I thought was interesting is, and this extends to other areas of the transgender argument, transgenderism has been sold to the American people as, you know, one way that this would be, you know, being born one gender, living as another, one way in which people who suffer from gender dysphoria alleviate their mental anguish. Gender dysphoria being a condition in which, as according to the American Psychiatric Association, the DSM-5, in which the way a person sees themselves in their mind is completely out of whack with their biology, their sex-based biology. So it's basically, if you listen to people talk who have gender dysphoria, which I do think is real, that they, you know, if it's a man who sees himself as a woman, you know, every time he's reminded of his genitalia, he's just horrified. It's very traumatic. Same goes with the woman. And here you have birthing people, which is meant to be inclusive of transgender. But if you're a biological female who has gender dysphoria living as a man, wouldn't giving birth be the most traumatizing event that could possibly happen to you? Isn't that the most woman thing imaginable? So the Biden administration, if Democrats and liberals were trying to change this language in order to be compassionate, that would still be stupid, but understandable at least. But we're not looking at that. It seems we're looking at fashion. And we all know how trendy transgender is at the moment. Because if you're really suffering from gender dysphoria, you would do everything you can to forget your biology and to try to live as the other sex.
He is Chadwick Moore, contributing editor for The Spectator. Chadwick, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Get your deplorable little face up next to the radio or your phone, iPad, computer, smart speaker, or filling in your mouth that somehow picks up this frequency. Because it's time for America's favorite tribute rip-off radio program, Animal Stories. And now, here in person, is the Rip-Off Animal Stories news team anchor man, woman, human, or whatever pronoun they go by, Dan Proft.
Ooh.
And Amy Jacobson.
Yeah, it's Shark Week, and so just in the interest of getting the lexicon correct, marine experts and advocates in Australia are urging the public to refrain from using the word attack in reference to sharks. Because it unfairly stigmatizes sharks.
Oh, so you can't say shark attack when it's an actual attack by a shark.
Instead, run-ins with sharks should be dubbed with more neutral words, such as, I had an interaction with a shark.
And how did the interaction go? Did it end well?
Let me use this in a sentence.
Yes,
just
please
to drive it home. So I was out swimming in the ocean. I had an interaction with a shark, and now I only have one arm. You see?
And the shark, I had an interaction with a shark. They ate off my arms and my legs.
Yeah.
And my name is Baba. Oh, see, no?
Yeah.
No.
That's right. You love those. You love those disabled jokes.
No, I do. Oh, come
you
on.
You love those jokes targeting disabled people. Right. Like, what do you call a guy with no arms and no legs stapled to a wall?
Oh, what?
Art.
Oh, I thought you were going to do no arms and no legs at your front door. Matt.
Right, exactly.
You're you know what?
Sick. That's
I was just
sick.
Trying to. I'm sorry. Do I have to atone for my sins?
You should be ashamed of yourself. Also, too, this for pet owners. You know, we were talking with Curtis Sliwa, who has 16 cats in his little place in New York City.
Meow, meow. It doesn't smell, I'm sure.
Holy cow!
Holy cat!
Responsible pet ownership, like shark attack. No
shark interaction.
It's interaction with a shark. Because they're majestic creatures. Responsible pet ownership, you know what that screams of. Using that term, that phrase?
What?
Racism. White supremacy. Researchers at the University of Denver's Institute for Human-Animal Connection, where I believe you have a certificate, argued in a paper by scholars. Punishment to support the need to align animal control enforcement with human social justice movement. Great read. They conclude, driven by racism, classism, and the white dominant culture, the legal concept of responsible pet ownership is largely unattainable for anyone in the U.S. other than white, middle, and upper class individuals. This includes animal welfare practices such as providing shelter, behavioral training, or veterinary care. That's the province of white, middle, and upper income people. And so responsible pet ownership, don't go talking about being a responsible pet owner, because what you're doing is promoting white supremacy. Providing shelter, not providing shelter, same thing. Behavioral training, not providing behavioral training, same thing. Veterinary care for your pet or not, no veterinary care, same thing. It's all equivalent. Equity. We're in the equity game, including when it comes to pets. And by the way, ownership. Can you even say ownership smacks of slavery?
What are we going to say instead of ownership?
Say an animal.
I'm a pet owner. I'm a pet advisor.
No.
I'm a pet.
I have interactions. I have interactions with my dog.
Okay.
You have interactions with your cats.
Because it's not a shark attack.
Interactions. Okay. We're equals.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and Amy, yes, it's that time. Open mic Friday. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line. Take your calls with comments, concerns, compliments, criticisms, crack pottery. We'll take it all, and we'll try and get through as many calls as possible. So hang on or keep trying if the lines are jammed, which I think they are now. I want to start the presser yesterday with Jen Psaki. It wasn't just punctuated by the Orwellian guidance on eliminating dissent in America. It was also on this remarkable statement that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken made, where he announced he would formally invite UN human rights officers to investigate America. You know, it's one thing to say we're not to hear other countries say we're not exceptional, we're just like everybody else, and we're just, you know, we have no standing to say anything about what's going on with the Uyghurs in China, for example, because, you know, we've got our own problems with race relations and so on and so forth in America. It's another thing for other countries to say that. It's one thing for other countries to say that. It's another thing for our government to adopt that as their position as well. Here's Psaki essentially reiterating what Blinken said.
Secretary said in his statement, he believes responsible nations must not shrink from scrutiny of their human rights record. Rather, they should acknowledge it with the intent to improve it and also push and lift up and put a shine a light on other countries that need to do better. And that is the role we're playing here from the United States.
Well, Senator Marco Rubio, little Marco, from Florida, had this to say in response to that.
I assure you of this. There are like 199 other countries that we should worry about on human rights before we get to America. In America, we have transparency. Okay? In America, we have a press that covers whatever they want. Sometimes they lie. Sometimes they cover. Sometimes it's a half-truth. But you do something wrong in America, it's all over the place. We have a system of courts. We have people go to jail here because they do things that are not right. And so I think that before you get to the human rights record of the U.S., if you're going to rank them in order of problematic, there's like 199 other places we'd have to deal with first.
I'll tell you, it's just remarkable. They take the position, do these neo-Marxists, neo-Nazis, that America has no moral authority, and they're going to make sure we don't. Amy, you had something for Open Mic Friday.
Yeah, I'm kind of concerned about this new program in Chicago to stop crime. Mayor Lightfoot making the big announcement yesterday. Unless you'd rather talk about the man.
They're gonna
have this hotline for $1 million reward.
Line.
Yeah, it's a snitch line, but details, they didn't release any details of how it's gonna work. And if I'm mad at you, Dan, I could call the snitch line and turn you in.
Yeah.
Or put police on your tail make your life H-E double hockey sticks.
Right.
Because the tips can be anonymous.
Waste of time. I know. Unserious people. And what can you say about this? These lotteries, these gun buyback programs, these snitch lines with cash rewards, just wasting people's time. It's a misdirection play to give the appearance that you're doing something to combat the lawlessness that you've unleashed. It's embarrassing. But these are people that are incapable of embarrassment. Let's go to the lines. Laura in Rolling Meadows.
Hey, good morning. Happy Friday. So I was at the District 214 meeting last night, but believe it or not, that's really not what I'm calling about.
Did they vote on masks last night, or when are they going to do that?
They did not vote. They discussed it, but apparently, you know, it's going to require 2 weeks of deep thinking and hand-wringing, they're going to vote on it in 2 weeks, right? Yeah. They need more time to study the science and data.
Uh-huh, sure.
Oh, what a farce. So anyways, I'm calling about a different topic. My daughter is going to be a freshman in college next year. Time flies. She's going to DePaul, and that's why I'm calling. After she got accepted, DePaul introduced a vaccine mandate, which we're not happy about.
Catholic school, but, of course, right.
Of course, exactly. And I also want to mention, students are required to get vaxxed, but the staff is not.
Of course.
Of course. So my daughter received a medical waiver for the vaccine from an MD, a board-certified MD, not some snake oil salesman, et cetera. The exemption was filed with the university, and they granted it. And we thought, great, we're in good shape. This week, DePaul sent us an email saying, my daughter can still attend the university, but they're not going to allow her to live in the dorms. So she's going to be a freshman living on her own, apparently, if we have to go that route. And it's just amazing to me that the university continues to find ways to separate these students into two classes. I don't understand how they can get away with this. I'm not a legal expert, but it seems to me like an ADA violation.
Yeah, I think, Laura, thanks for the call. I think you actually do have a colorable claim there. I really do.
And she should pursue it.
You think that's bad. Did you see the lawsuit filed by parents in Washington, D.C.? The District of Columbia passed a municipal regulation that enables children ages 11 and older to consent to a vaccine if they're deemed capable of meeting the informed consent standard. They can 11 and older can get vaccinated without their parents' approval. So parents
without their permission, that is crazy.
Yeah. So parents are in. Well, I mean, 11, you can understand why. I mean, these are people who say the same thing about abortion, right? You know, you don't need, you know, mom and dad. 11 years old on the vaccine, and so these parents are suing. I mean, like, there's a lot of litigation that should be advanced against what is happening at the K-12 or even the municipal level in the case of D.C. I mean, it's preposterous. And in many cases, I think it's pretty clearly on the wrong side of the law. Teresa on the north side.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. I have a question for you both. In your opinion, if they try to shut us down again, do you think most people will go along with it or just say, oh, hell no, we're not going through that again?
In Chicago, they're definitely going to go along with it. No question.
Yeah.
And we can have rallies up our yin-yangs, and I don't know if it's going to make a difference.
That's not the proper place to have a rally. That's part of it.
No, yeah.
Thanks for the call, Teresa.
I'm scared because, again, masks mandates are back in Los Angeles. And if you look at this, and I'll tweet it out, it's not even it's a slight bump in cases. And they're going all crazy again and locking things down. It's just ridiculous. No one's exercising common sense.
I think the extent to which people would go along with it again is the extent to which they're paid to go along with it.
Oh, yeah. Remember, what's in it for them? You're right.
I think, you know, and I think you probably get some more pushback maybe this go around. But I mean, is there like a political reckoning for triple threat coming on this? Or Jelly Belly? No, I don't think so.
But I am so fearful. Again, the woman that is one of our parishioners at church, works for Lane Tech, is big in the union, told me flat out, I don't think we're going back. We're not going back 5 days a week next year for CPS. And that scares me to death.
Steve in Orland Park.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I have a question to ask you. I'd like your personal opinion on this.
Yeah.
Outside of family and children, I'm speaking specifically of friends. Do you think it's a good idea to let those friends know that they're in your will or trust?
What?
I want a serious answer to this. This isn't a joke to me.
Is it a good idea to let your friends know that you've put them in your will?
Do you think that's a good idea or not?
Well, I mean, if they're your friends, I mean, what would be the downside? Are you worried that they're going to try and knock you off or something if you tell them that there's something in it for them when you passed on to your eternal reward. I don't know. I mean, I guess if your family knows they're in your will, if it's a good enough friend to be in your will, what's the downside?
You know? Well, I think it's just subconscious or conscious thought that I think people can't help, since you're a social animal, and that's why. I wonder about this, have one foot on the banana peel here, maybe. I don't know, a cloud over your head, a target on your back.
No, I mean,
whether they like to think that way or not.
I mean, if it was your wife was taking out a bigger insurance policy on you, that may be a little bit more concerning. But I don't know. I mean, if it's a friend, maybe if, you're leaving them, maybe they're spending the money they expect. I don't know. I think, as someone who doesn't have friends, it's hard to fathom this issue.
And you're going to leave everything to Hayek.
Yeah, like Leona Helmsley.
Exactly.
In so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Steve. I don't know. We'll take other opinions on this, but I don't see any reason. This is sort of like an Eric and Kathy topic. Do they still have a show?
No, they don't.
But yeah, I don't see any reason why. If it's good enough friend to bequeath something to, I don't see any reason why not. Maybe they can plan accordingly.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Oh, or maybe they'll reciprocate, because who knows who's going to go first. I say, Steve? I'll tell you what. I'll see your Barca lounger, and I'll raise you my riding lawnmower.
Huh? Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. What do you think? Do you have something you want to tell me? You're going to leave your welfare benefits to me?
Maybe. You get a little piece of the PEBT card.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. You've benefited from the PEBT card, too. Don't.
Unwittingly.
That filet mignon.
Unwittingly.
Yeah, you're right. But it was good.
You passed.
We used to have good eats. Now we don't.
You passed government cheese onto me and the boys here.
You're darn right I did.
That's how we get
Ronald Reagan favorite, government cheese.
Grant in Rockford.
Good morning, you two. Good show, as usual. Nothing real profound to say here today. What did you say earlier this week? Is it Wheaton and Evanston that voted to not enforce masks at school?
Certainly not Evanston. Wheaton.
No, not Evanston.
Yeah,
Wheaton, that's it.
Wheaton,
okay.
Yes.
That gives a little hope for my daughter. They're kind of glossing over it here out where we are. The meeting minutes on the school website, they don't bring it up, but there's a school board meeting coming up, and I think a lot of parents are planning on attending. I see a lot of unmask our children signs in my area, so I think there's hope, maybe.
All right.
I don't know.
Wait,
and,
Jill.
All right.
I don't know. You hear the rest of the national news you guys say get depressed as hell, and I just wonder how far they can push the envelope. Have a good one.
Thanks for the call, Grant. Grant, who's hopeful out in Rockford.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
Hey, don't be a downer. Grant, don't rain on Grant's parade. He's trying to cling to a shred of hope in this godforsaken place.
It's going to rise and fall. The little cases. This is seasonal. This is the flu. COVID is the flu. So come the fall, September and October, yes, there are going to be more cases. And I am just praying to God that our government overlords don't overreact and shut everything down.
I think your government overlords demand that you pray to them. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks, Amy and Dan, for taking my call. Missed seeing your video feed today. Amy, you wanted to discuss District 214. As you know, I was there last night.
And 214, for those of you scoring at home and don't know districts by numbers,
that
would
know?
Be...
It's Hersey, BG.
Yeah.
It's right. Only... Yeah. It's a mid-suburban
seven
league.
Schools.
Okay, it's
yeah.
Seven schools. It's
Arlington
Heights.
Heights
large.
Elk Grove
yeah.
Village.
Yeah, right.
Rolling Meadows, yes.
Prospect.
Prospect.
Yeah.
It's the second largest high school district in the state.
And yeah. It's all high schoolers.
Real impressive. All right, go ahead.
As your first caller mentioned, that they started off the discussion with various parents talking about masking. And again, the board just took testimony from the parents. Dan, you've talked about many of the issues that the parents brought up. Masks don't work. The kids are pretty much immune to the virus. If they get it, it doesn't affect them. A couple of the parents, or one in particular, was pretty emotional with regards to the fact that some of those children that do take the vaccine have side effects. and mentioned some report with regards to the numbers.
All right, well
Bob, how many pro-masker people were there?
What was the top-line takeaway from the meeting? What the hell's going on at 214?
They didn't vote.
Right.
And then another topic that was brought up was critical race theory, just a little bit.
They need to study that some more, too, I presume, right?
Yeah, and then a couple of other minor issues that the board members brought up. Masks are needed on buses. If you're going to the school and you're on a bus, you still need to wear a mask. Whether you're vaccinated or not.
Oh, because that's a... Well,
it's a super spreader.
Thanks for the call, Bob, because that's a high-risk environment or some such thing.
This is all just political theater right now.
Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. I got a question. You were talking to like an economist Thursday morning, and you were talking about all the dire things that are going to happen with the runaway debt and the like. But over, I mean, it's the same arguments for the last 1,000 years about you got to get this debt under control. It's running away. Somebody's grandkids are going to pay for it. But the first group of grandkids they were talking about having to pay for it are probably grandparents now. And if you were to find one of those people and ask, hey, how do you guys pay the debt down? They're going to say, well, we didn't. Because look at it. It's a runaway train. It just keeps on rolling. I mean, I think these grandkids that are going to have to pay this debt down are like unicorns. They don't exist. Nothing changes. It's the same talk, you know, same arguments year after year, decade after decade, and everything just keeps rolling on and rolling on. And it's like the teachers' pensions. They're bankrupt. They're billions of dollars in the red, yet no teacher has not gotten a pay pension check. And I'm like, if I go bankrupt, my employees aren't going to get paid, but these teachers get paid no matter how deep in debt the fund is, they still get their checks. So it's like nothing changes. And if I may do one more thing, they said back in the day you were wearing parachute pants, and so did I. Uh-huh. But I think I went up there in a parachute pants because I had the kind you could unzip the leg and have parachute pants short. And that's a good look in any decade.
Well, that is.
Oh, the tearaways.
No.
Partial tearaways.
Yeah, I did have tearaways. Thanks for the call, Rick.
Oh, my God. Did
too.
You ever. You didn't show your yams, did you?
My yams?
Your gams.
What?
Your legs. Gams. What
gams.
Do you call-
yeah. Gams. Yams is part of Thanksgiving dinner. Gams is an old school word for legs. Yeah.
For legs.
Yeah.
Did you show your gams?
No, I mean, no, I like the tear offs, like to play basketball.
Right,
or something.
But you could unzip the parachute pants and so that you could have shorts.
Well, not what Rick is talking about.
Oh,
but I mean, I'm sure I was a better breakdancer than Rick. I mean, it's just the break.
Do you have video of you breakdancing? Because we could make this go viral.
The breakdancing really posse in Wheaton was known in DuPage County to be superior to the breakdancers in Downers Grove.
Oh,
it's just a fact.
Just like Arlington Heights better than Mount Prospect, yeah. We get it.
Where's Chuck from Delavan?
Chuck! Peyton, maybe Chuck went on vacation. Or maybe he got the vid.
No. What are you talking about?